Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today I'm joined by David Hedges, who is our fifth place 2025 FKT of the Year winner for his 1 day, 11 hour, and 23 minute supported Nolan's 14 FKT. David, thanks for coming on the show today. Congratulations on being our fifth place FKT of the Year.
Thanks, Heather.
I'm looking forward to chatting with you again. It's just been a couple of years since we talked about your Nolan's 14. And here we are again, ready to talk about it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my first question for you is, why did you go back?
I mean, I guess I reclaimed. I lost, you know, Francois Dehaene.
Right.
Staged a huge FKT campaign in July and then broke my previous time by 3.5 hours. So then I just came back with some local crew in September.
So had this been on your radar until he broke your record, or was that kind of a decision just based on that?
No, just based on that.
Yeah.
I knew there were different ways of going faster for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And there is always a speculation of what could like a big time person, runner, athlete do. And yeah, I think it's a route that you just, it's kind of like, you know, it's not like a Roger Bannister metaphor, but in the sense that no one really knows how fast you can, like, you know, like break 60 hours is the standard, right? And then 40 some was considered like untouchable for quite a while. And then when Joey Campanelli broke or set 42, which he had for, I think, 3 years, like no one even tried until I tried in 2020. So it was just like, there were no, and when I went in 2023, I didn't even have any splits written down at all. So it was really kind of more adventure-y. And I feel like when Francois showed up and put down like a, you know, kind of a competitive race-esque time with a ton of help, it sort of like defined the splits and defined the paces and the sort of rhythm you had. You could do it. You could sort of like set out at. And so then, yeah. So when I came back, I was like, yeah, much more in a race style.
Mm-hmm. And did you have his splits with you? Were you kind of basing your timing off of his splits, or did you do something different?
I mean, I had the first few in mind and then the last, I mean, mountains. In between, it's like, you know, you kind of just have to think of it as the night section. Also, the middle 8 or so 14ers are a lot more close together.
Mm-hmm.
So the interesting thing, though, is that he had slowed down for La Plata or Huron La Plata, Elbert and Massive to roughly my pace from 2023, which was roughly Joey Campanelli's pace.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty damn similar. And so that kind of gave me some encouragement that, like, you know, there's time to be had. And also, like, you could just race harder the first day and then just hang on, you know?
Mm-hmm. So was that primarily what you did differently, was just going out harder initially? Or what other things did you do differently?
Let's see. I had more pacers and crew. Definitely not as much as Francois did, not even close. But yeah, so I kind of had more. Yeah, the splits were a lot more. The ranges for, you know, when I would show up were tighter.
Mm-hmm.
And my fueling was a little bit more on point, although with the wintry conditions and a few snafus like it, I didn't really feel it great. But yeah, I took it out kind of hard and then pushed through to like midnight probably. Or yeah, it's been a few months, so I don't remember exactly like the exact. But yeah, I took a few route deviations. I mean, like I did the Columbia-Harvard Traverse this time, which shaves a couple miles, maybe 700 feet of climbing. But I also did it in solo in the middle of the night in like really wintry conditions, really windy. So I don't know if that saved me too much time.
Right.
And then there was a small route that was kind of contested, like on the bottom of La Plata, the north side. There's a, like the typical way is you basically go to the La Plata trailhead and then just hit the road for a couple miles and then hop on the Elbert climb. Mm-hmm. But various folks like Andrea and Andrew, her partner, had found different like cuts across the river there, the creek, that like you have to like be quite careful because there's public you know, private land and all this. But anyways, so Francois had found actually like a really good cut through there. So I copied that as well.
Okay.
But otherwise, yeah, I think the big, I had Morgan Elliott, a really strong runner and friend of mine, pace me through like midnight to 5 a.m. or so, which was clutch. And then Noah Williams, who's a local Leadville guy, took me down, well, joined me for Elbert and Massive. And he knew the line off Massive really, really well. So that was a giant, because basically it, Francois and I were on the I was on Francois's exact split on the top of Massive. So I had a, you know, race to the end. And Noah, like, being really encouraging and knowing the lines really well helped a ton, because, I mean, because it came down to just 10 minutes at the end. So
I was wondering, like, you mentioned, you know, those cuts at La Plata. And I noticed when I was reading your trip report, there was also something about the La Plata closure as well that you had to contend with. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I started training for doing Nolans again in like late July, I think. And yeah, so I had basically 7 weeks of training. And I think like the last weekend in August, somebody started a fire off the La Plata trail.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They left their vape pen and tin food and all this stuff. And it was, you know, like 10 feet off the trail. So, and it started like a small but pretty intense fire right there. And, you know, that's off the road to Aspen, you know, Independence Pass. So, and quite a bit of, like I was saying, with those, that private property area, that's, you know, the county then has to protect those zones.
Right.
Even if, so they closed the entire north aspect of the mountain and brought out dozens of fire personnel. And yeah, so it was just straight up closed, like not just the trail, but the alternatives, Ellingwood Ridge, which is a little bit further east and a bit more technical, but still direct. But that was closed as well. So basically stressed out and started like emailing and voicemailing and calling every Forest Service person I could sort of like find, or like the supervisor, this, that, and the other. And the district ranger in Leadville was like super generous, super helpful, and basically gave me permission to cut through the area within like a 3-hour time period on the like the early morning when I went through.
Oh, wow.
So of course we had then gotten hit by a gigantic snow or thunderstorm, which had dumped quite a bit of snow. So they lifted the order soon thereafter, actually.
Right.
But yeah, it was definitely stressful, especially with coordinating crew. And yeah, but thanks to the Forest Service guy. And I mean, obviously it's like, you know, it was closed for a good reason. Like,
right,
they're doing their job, you know.
And where you crossed through, were you actually anywhere near the fire, or was it, you know, just closed from an abundance of caution that high up the mountain?
No, it was right next to the fire.
Oh, okay.
I mean, so by the time I went through, yeah, because the dude set the fire right off the trail.
Okay.
Which is in a pretty tight little valley there. So, but by the time I went through, the major fear was actually like the mud, like frozen mud. Mm-hmm. Like part of the problem is that the Forest Service didn't want to bring too many fire personnel in because the burn zone had turned into like pretty sloppy. And they didn't want to risk injury. So they couldn't really get boots on the ground until, because it was raining for quite a while, you know, until I think a couple days after I was through. But that also meant there was no fire personnel that I was interfering with. So,
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, it's Colorado. There were still plenty of footprints in the snow. And
yeah,
even though the trail was close.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
but out of enough, you know, just to be kosher, I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. So you've mentioned the snow. So could you talk a little bit about the conditions? Because I'm pretty sure when you did the Nolans last time, it was in the summer. So you had, you know, kind of prime summer conditions. So I can imagine snow would have interfered a little bit with what you're doing out there.
Yeah. So, I mean, in 2023, I did it in early July and it was the hottest ever day in Leadville.
Right.
Really not ideal at all, actually.
Right.
There was still plenty of water on the road.
Other extreme.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, between the two, I think being super dehydrated is worse.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. Although shivering isn't great either. But yeah, it was like, yeah, like all the exposed ridges were just getting pummeled from wind from the west. And since the south-north line, it's a pretty constant.
Right.
Like 40 plus mile per hour winds and really, really cold, especially, the first day, especially. And then, it was September. So the night section was like over 11 hours. But it was also like I camped on Angel Shimano trailhead the night before the attempt. And so I couldn't really see how, like, it was a huge thunderstorm while I was camping, but I couldn't see how much snow had accumulated.
Oh.
So I really wasn't prepared. And there was like so much to juggle between like the various crew. I had like basically bags set and logistics for like different sort of small groups, people, because, because it wasn't like I had a crew chief who could just be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's not that hard to drive, across the crew access points, but I just had, so anyways, I just didn't like distribute warm clothes enough. So I was pretty cold.
Oh, wow.
And it was pretty wet too, especially the first day. So then it was like, my feet got wet almost immediately. And then it was cold, but yeah, I mean, it was incredibly pretty though, because we had like peaks, fall colors and snow at the top. So the gradient was like unreal. So that was inspiring.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to feel pretty miserable, at least you got something pretty to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I definitely feel like at the beginning where you're like, on the one you were dehydrated and the other you were shivering. I was like, that sort of sums up Colorado to me, all my experiences there. You're choosing between one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's either really hot or it's really cold.
Well, and in September, usually you're sweating during the day and then freezing at night.
Right. So. Exactly. Did you need traction devices or anything? Did you have enough snow and ice up there that was impacting you?
The biggest thing was that all the scree and stuff was stuck together. So like, yeah, off Missouri, which is really, really steep, but also like the best scree to set in the Sawatch was like really brutal.
Right.
And then Huron as well, actually right next to it, was really, really icy, because I think that was, I got started on a Saturday morning. So, and Huron's like the easiest 14, I mean, whatever, it's the shortest 14er. So the snow had been all tracked out on Saturday. So by the time I got through there at like 4 a.m. on Sunday, it was like just pure ice for like 1500 feet. But no, I didn't bring any traction. It was just like, it was just a bummer, because I was like, oh man, I could be going so much faster right now on these.
Right.
Like they should be easy. So it was just like kind of really frustrating. Also, La Plata was frozen, the whole north aspect too. So, which is also usually pretty easy. So not ideal, but you just do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that just makes it even more impressive to me. I mean, you took 4 hours off your previous time and you weren't able to do the fast scree descents. So that's even more impressive to me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I really wanted it. I'm in better shape. But the recovery was ridiculous. I dug really deep. It took forever to recover. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like it definitely was a harder, just like overall effort, it was just like a lot more intense than 2 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, also I feel like when you're cold for a really prolonged period of time, that takes a lot out of you.
Oh yeah. And I was like really low on calories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially the second day.
Was that because, I mean, at the beginning you said your nutrition was more on point, but was that because it was colder than you expected? So you didn't pack enough calories to make up for that? Or how did the nutrition, kind of play out on this?
Well, multiple problems. Well, first I screwed up. I just like didn't pack enough in the drop bags. Like passable, but just not as much as I needed. And then I don't know what, things happen up like at that altitude, like with kind of like your throat and mouth and all this stuff. And for whatever reason, I don't know, the wind or whatever, but I couldn't really swallow. Like I was really nauseous every time I tried to swallow. It was just like a chewing, like a swallowing reflex, which was really unfortunate, because then it was like all the kind of like, cold appropriate, like Clif Bars and Nut Butters or whatever I either packed or scrounged from my crew was hard to get down.
Mm-hmm.
And I had like made all these sandwiches for myself, which was a good idea, but between them being frozen and the throat thing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And so then I missed my crew at the bottom between Huron and La Plata, which was like really unfortunate. So in the end, I was just like really hadn't had sodium for a long time and was like way, way behind on calories. But yeah, so it was just kind of a screw up on my end and then just like bad luck. And then, yeah.
Right. So what did you end up eating?
I have this friend who makes sports nutrition called PEP. It's pretty cool. It's actually, yeah, it's like a whole like starch powders, basically, of various like very, very nice ingredients.
Okay.
For carbs, and then like salt, you can add salt. I mean, it has salt, and then you can add some. So it's like and caffeine as well. So I was doing that. So it's kind of like a whole foods powder type
thing. Is this like a drink mix then? You're putting it in fluids? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then those egg sandwiches. And then, yeah. And then by the middle of the night on when I saw Morgan Elliott, he had all this like beta fuel and whatever, just various more synthetic sugars, which then I kind of switched to when I could on the second day. So it was, yeah, it was a combination. Yeah. And I had a few Clif bars and stuff like that. Yeah. I don't know. I think I had a few other like pouches here. It was completely a hodgepodge type thing.
Right.
But yeah, I would say like pretty much real-ish food for the first day and then just sugar for the next day, the Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And I feel like that's the kind of stuff that's easier to get down when it's cold anyway, like liquid type foods. Because I don't know, I definitely have had the thing where the Clif Bar freezes and then you can't eat it. It's like a brick.
Yeah, you're like, you literally can't chew it. It's like,
unless you remember to like stick it in your jacket, you know, 20 minutes before you're ready to eat it. And yeah. So why did you miss your crew here in La Plata?
Well, my friend Matt was crewing me and he had just raced Ure 50 like the day before.
Oh, wow.
Or maybe the day of, actually. And he like crushed it. So he was tired, drove all the way over. And I mean, I'd done quite a bit of training with him actually, and he's a good friend. And I just didn't like double check the instructions because he's done Nolan's a couple times himself. But basically you either pop out on there's like an old mining road through Winfield, or you get on the CT. And he basically just parked at the road and not at the trail. So,
okay.
Simple as that. Yeah. So we were like, I don't even know if we were maybe like a mile away from each other, mile and a half. Yeah. So,
I gotcha.
But there was no real way to like, I mean, I think I tried to like satellite him, but it was also like getting down to crunch time. I think I was still behind or roughly even with Francois, and that's like a road. So I just had to kind of like go.
Yeah.
Anyways. So.
Yeah. I mean, when your time's that close, you don't have time to just sit around and wait and try to get your people to you. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was just like, yeah, it happens, you know.
Right. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about your pacers and your crew? Like how many people were involved and how often were you accompanied? How often were you seeing them? Just kind of what that looked like.
Let's see. I don't remember the exact number of people, but maybe like 8 to 12. Yeah, something. Pretty sizable amount.
Okay.
And most of those folks were crewing, and then I had some buddies from Santa Fe pace or join me basically for Princeton or part. Yeah, Princeton. And then I had a friend join me for part of Yale. And then Morgan met me on the top of Oxford. So he did Oxford, Belford, Missouri, and Huron with me. And then I did La Plata solo. And then Noah was with me for Elbert and Massive. So I think I did like, if you broke it up into peaks, I think I did like 8 solo or maybe 7. I don't know, something like it was, yeah, whatever, 2/3 supported, something around there. But yeah, I was definitely alone. I mean, I was alone for the first two and then, you know, part of Yale, Harvard, Columbia, and then like the climb up to Oxford. So yeah, it was partially supported, partially right. Solo.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely sounds like you had people with you when you really needed it.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And then the crew was like amazing too. I had like some old friends from, you know, Pierre Maximo was there, Aaron Ton, who's probably, I'm sure, has been on the show, and had, yeah, like I said, my friends from Santa Fe. So it was like a really nice group, just like very supportive and stoked and Yeah.
How frequently were you seeing your crew? How many road crossings are there?
There's Alpine, then there, I saw some folks. Oh yeah. So Alpine, so that's between Chavano and Princeton, and then between Princeton and Yale. So that's 1-2. Then at like there's a trail called North Cottonwood. So that's, but that wasn't really crew, but okay, let's see. Yeah, it's like five altogether, I think.
Okay.
Five plus the start and end. So yeah, it's kind of, I mean, so that's the thing with Nolans is like you really can treat it like a 100 mile or if you know, like a race. Like people think about it, have thought about it in those terms. I mean, maybe without necessarily doing it, but yeah. And that's why, I mean, like when Francois did, I mean, he had someone with him the entire time, like doing all the navigation. So, but that was doable because like you could burn pacer, he could burn pacers and like, yeah.
So what was your highest high and your lowest low?
I mean, going up Princeton with like a few friends and the colors and everything was like really nice. That was probably the middle of the day on Saturday. And then the low would be, yeah, so I did that Columbia Harvard traverse, which was like kind of gnarly. And then Harvard had all these snow drifts going on the descent and like really cold. And then between Harvard and Oxford, there's like a wetlands area, which
Oh.
I was sort of hoping that, which is actually pretty remote. Like I couldn't scout it, but I was sort of hoping that like fall it would be kind of dry. But
Right.
between the rain and the big monsoon season in the summer, it was like a giant lake. And
Oh.
so I was just like really, I was really running low on calories and like my headlamp was flickering. And yeah, so I was like wading through there up to my thighs solo. And then I just made this big mistake going up. Like there's a, Oxford's pretty steep, especially at the bottom. And like, it was a shame because the elk had already been through there on their migration. So actually, the route I had done last time and like had put together and should have taken was really well trodden because it's an elk trail.
Right.
But I was out of it and I just like kind of like beelined it up this cliff and got like really, yeah, cliffed out. And I was like sliding through the trees and all that because the ground was frozen. It's like a really, really rough. And then going up Oxford, I was like shivering and everything. So because that's also the west wind was just like slamming me after being all wet too. So yeah, that whole thing was pretty bad.
Yeah, that sounds pretty terrible.
Yeah. Well, and I was just, oh, and you know, so I was moving slow and then I was like, oh man, I actually made a mistake and lost like 15, 20, 25 minutes, maybe even, yeah, at least 15, just being an
Right.
idiot. So
Yeah.
yeah, it was just like demoralizing on all fronts. So, but then I saw Morgan at the top of Oxford and he had like an extra jacket, gloves, hand warmers. So that really turned it, food. So that really turned it around. Yeah.
That's good. So I guess we've talked about the fact that there was snow and stuff like that, and that you were really cold. But what were the temperatures like? How cold was it when you were wading through a swamp?
I mean, like in the 20s, I think.
Wow. So it was well below freezing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Maybe, yeah, maybe like 30.
that's pretty horrible. I feel like wading into water when it's that cold would just be absolutely the worst thing ever.
Well, I was just remembering like I did some backcountry skiing with some friends over the winter and like some of those you have to like take your boots off and go through and yeah, there's ways to kind of put it into perspective, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
What about your crew? I mean, obviously, everything was kind of in place before this started. Were they also struggling? Because obviously, you didn't have enough warm stuff packed for yourself. Did they have enough time to be prepared? Obviously, I guess he brought you an extra jacket. So, sounds like maybe they had a
Yeah.
little bit of a chance to reassess based on the weather.
Yeah, Morgan was totally dialed. But yeah, like my friends going to Princeton, it was kind of a disaster because that's like a pretty long sort of exposed ridge and it was quite icy. And then the descent that is like really notorious and it's just like because it's these loose kind of like I don't know, table-sized boulders. I don't know, they're like biggish boulders, but not big enough that they don't slide. They're kind of like moving.
Oh, yeah, I've been on that.
And that was like covered with like ankle deep snow. So you just had no idea where you're putting your feet and everything.
Right.
Really, yeah, that was pretty heinous. So there it was like we were all three of us were super cold and I just had my pacer Chris just not even summit and just head down early. And then I summited, then headed down like the main chute, which took a while, but it was just like, you know, this is like how you're going to break an ankle. But at the bottom, it was fine. And I met Chris and then we just wrapped it up. So basically after that, we were like, okay, I think the word got out that it's like, yeah, this is the above whatever it was, 12,500 feet. It's pretty rough.
Did you or anybody else fall or get hurt in these conditions? Or did everybody manage to navigate this without injury?
So the first two, Shivano and Tabawatch, had like, or sorry, three, Shivano, Tabawatch, and Antero. Between Tabawatch and Antero, there's like a pretty steep, gnarly little couloir type thing. And that was like, you know, freshly frozen. It was because that runs water. So the water was frozen and then there's snow on top of it. And I was like falling quite a bit. I actually got pretty bruised up.
Oh, wow.
But I also knew that was like the worst it was going to get because there'd be some melt between, because that was whatever, 8 a.m. and really sheltered north aspect. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And then Antero was snowy and everything, but totally manageable. Yeah. The big one was Missouri because Morgan was with me. And like I was mentioning, the ground was frozen. So we were just like, we were both, you know, just falling out of, you just kind of, yeah, inevitable. But rocks were still like flying past, you know, we were kicking rocks on each other. And then like some of the rocks above us started budging after we went down for a few minutes because it was like, yeah, whatever frozen behavior that's going on up there. And so that was actually pretty terrifying. Like, it was pretty scary.
Yeah, that sounds like it.
But no injuries.
That seems almost miraculous given the conditions.
Yep.
So if this summer somebody comes and breaks your record, are you going to go and take it back?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've done like so much training. I mean, I like the training and everything, but it is, I feel like maybe someone could put it out there, but who's, you know, who's interested and who's going to do it. It's like quite a lot. It's quite a commitment, I think. Like I put so many years working on the route and memorizing it, all this stuff. And obviously Francois didn't really do that. So I guess you could replicate that, but it's like, who has the budget to do, you know, who has a bunch of people with all that time and, you know, so yeah, but no, I don't think I'll go back next year, certainly, maybe in a few years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for now, you're pretty satisfied.
Yeah, I definitely have had my experiences. I'm good to go.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing about this. It sounds like it was definitely quite an adventure.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Thanks again, David, for coming on the show. You can read about his FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow his adventures on Instagram at dhedges_.